session number 14974, Paul Armstrong, reel 27.
Armstrong, reel 27. You were talking about a visitor concentration camp.
Yes, a visit I wish I'd never made. I must admit, I went sheer idle curiosity because one had heard about concentration camps, but I'd never encountered one. And so I went with two of my brother officers, went not a long way off, few hours driving.
You can't recall which one it was.
Oh, Belsen. But the shock. To this day, I find it hard to believe that I saw such a thing. When you talk about being sorry for the Germans that had been dealt with as there were in Hamburg and various other towns. When you think about this, the way it was, the people were treated, they weren't human. And at that time, another engineer unit were working with masks over the faces, digging deep trenches, and actually bulldozing the bodies into it. The bodies weren't the colour of people. The bodies were a kind of coppery colour, I suppose, fawny. They weren't pink. They were just a fawny colour. The teeth showed very clearly, but the bodies were just like matchsticks. It was hard to tell what sex they were. It was almost impossible. There were just heaps, and these heaps were 6 feet deep, and they were having to bulldoze them into these, and there was no blood flowing. The bodies were just possibly desiccated by that time. The Germans hadn't had time to get rid of them.
And you saw this yourself going around the camp?
Yes, it was on the outskirts that we saw it as we drove in. And I thought, oh dear, what have I done? And the British troops in charge, who were making the German, those of the German guards, warders, whatever you might call them, the German soldiers, whatever, those that hadn't been killed, and some were shot presumably by the troops liberating it, with horror. They must have shot them with the shock of what they'd seen. They were making them carry the bodies out of the buildings. The buildings themselves defy description. I saw them for a long time afterwards. If you can picture the sort of thing that battery chickens are kept in, only bigger, and the bedding was three planks long ways on. And those in the top were lucky because the excreta dropped down onto those below. But they weren't lucky in that at the end of the day they had to climb back into them, and they hadn't obviously the strength. And I learnt that when they died they didn't tell the guards because they drew the food for them till the bodies had to be dragged out. I saw the ovens. I saw where they hanged them. I saw the place where they gathered the false teeth, where they put the stored the hair that they cut off them. I can't describe further what it was like. But the horrifying thing was, there's a village nearby where the trains carrying these people had to pass through to get to the camp. And these people pretended they had no idea. And the officer that took over forced them at gunpoint, all the villagers, to go and walk round the camp to see what German soldiers had done, because they were pretending they knew nothing about it. He made sure that they did. Then they won't forget it. I don't think as I did.
How were the German soldiers that were working in the camp when you were there, was there any experience of how they were being treated by their own guards, the new guards, the British guards?
Once the police took over, there was no question of having them either shot or otherwise disposed of, but they weren't very... Our troops were actually guarding them from the prisoners, who would have torn them to pieces if they could have got hold of them. So it was a rather ironical situation that they were then, by that time, having to protect them. And they couldn't feed them, because as soon as you fed, the stomachs weren't used to it and they died. So that in a lot of cases, doctors said, well, they'll feed them with milk and gruel and things to try and get the stomachs working again, but they're so shrunken that they're rejecting, and he said most of these people will die.
So you took those memories back with you?
Yes. I was very sorry I'd been. My two other friends were very, very sick.
Has this changed your attitude towards the Germans
yes.
forever?
Yes. That is why when I read last week that that fool major was talking about Germans marching down Whitehall, it could include some of these people, could include the sort of people that could do what they did, could include some of the SS that murdered the Norfolks in France, that murdered them in 1940, that murdered them in 1940. No, I would never forgive the Germans. Never.
To come back to where you were, obviously, you came back, and you were established in Kiel itself.
Yeah.
What were the actual jobs you were now doing?
Well, the very first thing we noticed when we got back was that the Germans themselves had started clearing the roads. Not the German men. No, the German men in Kiel, like the German men in Hamburg, were well dressed and walked about with briefcases. But there were endless rows of women picking bricks up, handing them from hand to hand, until they were reached a point where German women were cleaning them and stacking them. Different women all the way. And so that shook us. But of course the German women had been mobilized. They say they weren't mobilized like the British were. The German women, when they couldn't use displaced persons, when they couldn't use prisoners, they had to do little jobs, and that wasn't until the very end of the war. But the German men couldn't bring themselves to do this sort of thing until we took over.
So they were walking around with briefcases, but
yes.
They weren't office types or going
no,
to
no.
work.
They were just pretending they were going from A to B. Just terrible. Dreadful. Anyhow.
Was there any form of local authority functioning?
Well, we're coming. This is what I found very interesting. A Colonel Tysak You'll have possibly heard of Tizac, the steel manufacturers from Birmingham, Sheffield. Colonel Tizac was an RETA officer, and he'd been made town major. Is was the title that they were given. There was an officer appointed to each town, and he was called the town major, and he had full authority. And I was with him the first time because at that time I was still, we hadn't settled down to any particular task, and we were still gathering information and the rest of it. And so Tizak said to me, he would go with me to the town hall, rat house. So I was always looking forward to a bit of interest, something new. So I went with him, and we walked in, because no one was prepared to show us in. We walked into the Burgomeister's office, and there there was this large, fat German sitting in the seat of justice. And Tizak walked up to him, and the German looked at him, and Tizak, by the way, spoke very, very fluent German, and Tizak told him he was going to take over, and this German more or less said, "Oh, really?" And then Tizak said, well, in German, "Get out." And this German hesitated for just a second. Tizak took his gun, pointed it at his head, took the first pressure, and the German shot out of his chair and stood there trembling, and said he was only wanting to be helpful. And Tizak said, "Well, you'll be helpful standing there telling me." And Tizak went and sat in the Burgomeister's chair and started dishing out orders. And the orders were, every man had to do the work that these German women were doing. He said he was going to give them the opportunity of organizing it themselves, but every man, as well as women, we didn't stop the women, every man had to be taking part in the job of clearing the roads. And he waited until orders were given, and the people went scuttling off. And it was then that I learned how thorough the Germans are, because they had books, enormous tomes. When you turn them over, for instance, if it was me, there'd be my name, or if I was living with my parents, there would be the name of my parents, our address, of course, how long we'd been living there, how many children my parents had, what denomination we had, where we came from, who was his father, and who was his father. It was all down in the book, and in everything, where he'd trained, which school he'd gone to, which... It was so incredible that one found it hard to believe, as I do now, the Germans are so incredibly thorough. So I left Tizak quite happily, dishing out orders, and he very, very rapidly got the Germans working, because he was there, he had the Burgomeister, and he had the power over them, all of them. It was that or concentration camp. Because if you wanted to speak to a German wrongly, you said, "Concentration Lager," and they jumped to attention. Colonel Tizak, of course, had his staff with him. I just went along as the representative of my unit to know what Tizak particularly wanted us to do that he couldn't at first do with his German labour. But he had, first of all, he had a profound detestation of the Germans. And second, because I understand that he'd learnt his German in Germany in the 30s when Hitler was rising to power. And so he was an ideal man for the job, because he was also a very talented engineer. And his staff were waiting to give given instructions, and as I understand, he took over the building and worked literally daily. He was a very, very hard driving man. But I heard him giving instructions through the burgomaster to the various water, electricity and various units of the local authority, and he insisted he wanted the lists of men who were working, and he had the book so that he could check it all. But as I say, he still left the women working. That was because nothing should hinder the regeneration of the city.
It's essentially, he would work through the German civilian authorities,
yes,
to put electric on or gas or
that's
whatever,
right,
whatever facilities were missing.
He started the whole thing rolling, and as I say, was a very determined and a very tough cookie, and certainly he left them in no doubt that if anyone was reluctant to do what they were supposed to do, he would see that they were removed and put into prison. It's easy as that.
Had all forms of aggression gone? You weren't in any way having any problems with Germans who were still...
There were quite a few displaced persons, quite a few German soldiers and sailors who'd deserted and were wandering about. One had to watch for that sort of thing. And what I did, well, later, I, at the end of the day, I used to like to go for a walk. Being an infantryman, I had to have exercise. Swanning about in the jeep's very nice, but one needs the exercise. And I went to the German police, and they trained police dogs that used to obviously hunt down prisoners and the rest of it, displaced persons, all this, that and the other. And that again was interesting, because they were still functioning just the same way, except that they were then under the orders of the British. There was a section of infantrymen in charge. And I went to ask for a dog, a guard dog, and they introduced me. They said, what do you do? They brought a bowl of food to me, and I had to hold it in my hand, and they brought a dog. And if a dog will take food from you, a guard dog, it is then yours. So this dog came in, this massive great Alsatian, nearly black, and he sniffed me, started at my toes and sniffed me right up to my head, every inch of me, eyes, face, mouth, everything, and I just stood there with the food. And then he stood back in front of me. I put the food down and waited, and he looked at me, and I said, come on. Oh, they told me his name was Bugle. I said, come along, Bugle, take it. And of course, he'd been trained in German, but he heard his name, and so he took the food. And they said, right, he's yours. And when he'd finished, I just called to him, and he followed me. Wherever I went, he went with me, but I must be honest, he didn't like driving in a jeep. He used to be very, very apprehensive, but he was always with me, and when I went for a walk, he used to quarter the area so that I didn't even bother to take my pistol. I never bothered with a gun. They were just a nuisance, and they were stupid things anyhow. So I kept him literally until the week I was going to be demobilised, and I knew I couldn't take him home, because we, by that time, we had two little ones. So I found a Scottish major, I remember very clearly, who desperately wanted a dog, and we went through the same process, and he took Bugle over, And whether it was his kilt or what, I don't know, but the dog took to him and I quietly slunk away. I was very sad because he was a beautiful dog. And what was more, he only had one habit that I couldn't cure him of. When chaps saluted me, he thought they were attacking me. And so he tended to menace. And that wasn't popular. And complaints were made until the garrison commander said he'd had these complaints made. And I said, yes, sir. I think you'll find that Bugle's perfectly well trained and won't attack anyone. And he went across to Bugle, this old colonel, patted him, looked at his mouth, did everything, and he said, nothing wrong with this dog. And so, of course, I had no further complaints. But whilst I was there, he was with me wherever I went.
Did you have any problems with the Germans at all in the time that you were there? I'm thinking in terms of attacks or...
No. This is what I said to you earlier, and this is what I cannot emphasize too much. When the Germans are on top, they're impossible. When they've been beaten, they're quite the reverse. They seem as though they lose everything. They're used to being ordered what to do and what to go, how to go about it. They're not people who improvise. When I think of, we could send a couple of sappers out somewhere and somehow or other they would carry out this task, even if they had to go and do a burglary to do it. They would carry these jobs out. You knew they would do it. We knew them so well. They were tradesmen, they were thinking men. And I was very, very happy with them all the time.
So what were the duties and jobs that you were now doing in town that you took over?
At that time, we then had several hundred German prisoners who were allocated to do the sort of tasks that the engineers were going to carry out. And we had eight officers, of course, in our unit. And so each of us would be allocated the eight obviously weren't on that sort of duty. We took turns, but you would have a couple of thousand men. And the first time I had these men were marched in and delivered, I thought, we have to find billets for them. And this was in Kiel itself. It wasn't at our headquarters. So I got in touch with Tysak and asked him where I could have a billet. And he said, oh, there's a factory which has been standing empty since the end of the war. It's in good shape and it's in the centre of the area that you are going to have to clear and have rebuilt. So I went to that factory, and it was locked. And these 2,000 Germans were decanted from the transport, and they were standing there. And I asked for the owner of the factory, and I had to have him brought out. Part of the factory was working further over, but I had to have him brought out. Once again, it's interesting, these burgomasters and senior men were all large, fat, treble-chinned people with the bullet heads. They all look exactly the same, like a mould. And this chap reluctantly came, and I said, open up this factory. I had an interpreter, by the way, by that time, a chap, an ex-Salvation Army man, who lived in London. So many had lived in London.
Who was this?
And this was the interpreter.
What was his name?
Oh dear. I'm sorry.
You seem to infer that these men, when they said they'd been in London before the war, that they were just there to find things out.
Yes, I felt that. I'm sorry, I did feel that, because I'd seen the organisation of Germany all over, wherever one went. There were facts about everything. So I concluded that a lot of the Germans who'd worked in England, in various places, had gone purely and simply to take, I'm not saying they were sent as spies, but they were told to collect information, told to take guidebooks, told to take, you name it, they took it back. Anyhow, this chap, he was a nice person, very pleasant, and a good interpreter. He spoke very good English. And so I said to the interpreter, tell him I want him to open the gates. And this chap said, he hovered and started to fool about, and then in the end he said he hadn't got the keys. This was before I'd disposed of my pistol. So I pulled my pistol out, and he could see by my face that I wasn't amused. He changed colour, he dropped on his knees and started pleading for mercy. And of course, all I was going to do, which I did, I shot the lock off, just literally blew it away, and called the foreman in charge of these. There were soldiers, obviously it was a sergeant major. Called the sergeant major across and told him to take his troops in. They walked over this fella till he got out the way, just as though he hadn't existed. It was laughable. Man, I wasn't amused at the time, I was livid. And he obviously was used to the fact that if you didn't refuse in the Reich, you were shot. And he expected it. When I pulled my gun out and he saw that I was cross, he thought I was going to kill him. As I've said to you earlier, and said again, in the British Army, they hang you for that.
So you now had...
So we got these people, and they worked very hard indeed. They did every task. You didn't need to tell them twice. They organised themselves into units. They collected all the tradespeople out that had been that in civil life, and obviously the first thing I remember, the first thing was made was a hospital. The hospital had been bombed to hell, and so on, started building different, putting different things together, getting services together. We had to, you know, the electricity had been, the bombing had been so great it had blasted electricity out. These men were doing that under the supervision of our sappers, where one sapper could be in charge of 100 men without any bother. The sewers had been smashed up. They had to be rebuilt. The water supply had to be put back. All of this was done by Germans through working under sappers and various NCOs.
So did the army feed them? Or was that a charge on the local authority?
As far as I'm aware, it was a charge on the local authority. I cannot remember seeing anyone from the British forces feeding them. I'm certain it was a charge on the Germans, particularly in view of the fact that Montgomery had issued word that they were so short of food in Germany at that time that we hadn't to take any or buy any. At the same time, I was busy. An interesting thing was the Navy and various other arms were going around seizing things. You can imagine Kiel, the Navy would want to. And my my interpreter was an ex-naval rating, and he told me, chattering away to me, he told me that there was the German Royal Yacht Squadron was based at Kiel and it was intact. And I thought, good Lord, I must seize that for the army later on, because we were already building a mess for the troops on the side of the canal, well, on the side of one of the marinas. So I shot down to the docks where these yachts were, and I was just in time. There was some naval blokes putting their stamp on various things, so I foxed them. I put on my mind booby trapped, and I put that on each of the boats, and I got that's one thing. The doctors were putting the yellow plague sign on, but that didn't deter many people, but the mine's booby trap sign did. And so I can claim that I saved the yachts, and they were still using them when I was in Germany in doing that job I did for the TA in 56.